Back in the 1970s and 80s, stories of police corruption and collusion with the mob became big headline news. But over the last several years, there's been relatively few scandals, and many people assumed that this type of behavior was no longer of much concern. But a new series called NYPD Inc. by Robert Lewis, a George Polk Award-winning reporter at this station, reveals how some members of the upper ranks of the NYPD engage in practices that could be seen as potential conflicts of interest and even to ties to organized crime. I'm very pleased that Robert Lewis could join us now. Welcome to our show.
Thank you very much.
This series revolves around how many police officers make money outside of the NYPD. What are the NYPD's rules about outside jobs and income?
Well, so they require officers to file some sort of application to take a secondary employment. And then after that, I mean, assuming it gets approved, that's pretty much it. There are some basic rules regarding the types of employment. There's a certain classification. They can't be locksmiths. They can't work at a bar or an establishment that serves alcohol. And then after that, there is a small subset of officers, really the top ones, who are required to file financial disclosure forms with the City Conflicts of Interest Board.
And that only applies to 130 top NYPD personnel. So why only 130?
Well, city law, the rules regarding conflicts of interest require basically any city officials, not just the PD, who can either set policy or make spending decisions to file these disclosures. And this is what the NYPD has determined meets that sort of criteria.
How does that compare to police departments elsewhere in the country?
It's significantly less. I looked at some departments like Chicago, which has a sort of a blanket requirement that anyone rank of, I believe it's lieutenant and above, to file a disclosure form with that city's Board of Ethics. If that were applied in New York, that would apply to 2,500 officers as opposed to the 130 you referenced. And I mean, to be fair, a sort of side point, the forms that we have here, the oversight here in New York, does appear to be much more serious, much stricter. The form that is at least publicly available in Chicago is much more bare bones. So we require more, but a significantly smaller number.
You're right that outside income that officers receive helps create a disconnect between the department leaders and rank-and-file officers.
Well, you know, the rank-and-file officers have been fighting for years to get a new contract. I mean, they just got one this year. There's long been a sort of gripe that this is an incredibly expensive city to live in, and you look outside in Long Island, for example, and the cops are making a bundle more than they're making within the city. And then you've got sort of some of these top officers who are making, some of them were making hundreds of thousands of dollars a year in side ventures.
Many of them make outside money in the test prep industry. How does that work?
So if you are a rank-and-file officer and you want to move up, you want to take the civil service exam for, say, to become a sergeant, there is this whole industry of courses, prep material, lectures to help you prep for the test, and it is run by largely current and former officers. And I mean, the former makes sense, but the current, they're the bosses are basically charging the rank and file for help passing these exams.
How much do these test prep classes cost?
They can be $700, $900, $1,000 for the courses plus all of the materials, and they pack them in. I mean, people who want to sort of pass these exams feel they will sort of give them an edge. And so, you know, I found some of the folks who actually own these companies, active duty individuals, you know, some years they were reporting making in the neighborhood of $500,000.
Wow. Just on test prep. But you say that the rank and file who want to move up, they see taking these courses as perhaps giving them an edge?
Certainly. I mean, you know, some of it makes perfect sense, right? Like you think of it as SAT prep. How many high school students would take an SAT prep course in the hope of, you know, getting an edge, getting advantage, getting, you know, if it helps you with one question on the test, is it worth it? You know, I did speak to some officers who there is a suspicion or a belief, perhaps unfounded, but there is a belief that, you know, maybe some of these instructors have inside knowledge of what'll be on the test. And so
they pass them on.
Well, you know, that is the suspicion, right? I mean, there is the civil service system here in New York. The tests are supposed to be written sort of confidentially. No one's supposed to know what's on it. You know, in theory, these instructors are not supposed to know what is on the exam. And the ones I talked to, they say, oh no, we don't know. But you know, I did find there was a captain who was, you know, a longtime instructor and involved in one of these test prep companies who helped write a test one of these years. And the owner of the company said, oh, you know, at that time he sort of stepped away and he had nothing to do really with helping the students that year. But, you know, it certainly would appear to feed into the perception.
And if I were somebody who was ambitious, I might see that there would be a disadvantage if I didn't at least avail myself of these opportunities.
And I think those are some of the core questions about why this might be a conflict of interest. Is this a conflict of interest? And if so, why? And I think the point you raise, I mean, to what extent are rank and file officers feeling pressure, feeling like if they don't pony up this money to some of these active duty guys, that they are going to be sort of maybe missing out on a career opportunity?
I'm speaking to WNYC's Robert Lewis, whose series NYPD Inc. is running currently. This is WNYC, WNYC.org. I'm Leonard Lopate. How many stories do you think you're going to have in the near future?
There should be more. I don't know. I'm sort of going where the reporting takes me, and it's fascinating. You know, one of the things I was struck by as I started in on this is just how little there appears to have sort of been looking at these sort of outside financial interests, and there's probably a lot of reasons for that. But yeah, it seems like a very unmined field.
Are there some cops who know about this and come to you with stories?
Certainly, you get tips and sources.
Your latest story focuses on NYPD Assistant Chief Edward De La Torre, who works in Staten Island. What did you learn about his sources of outside income?
So, I did an initial story in November on this assistant chief. I found that I sort of dubbed him as having the most entanglements of any of these top officers in the department. He owns a private security company. He's done business, bought properties with local business leaders, rents space in one of those buildings to a politician and state assemblyman.
He also maintains an office there, doesn't he?
Exactly.
His, it gets complicated.
Yes, it gets quite complicated. And he purchased the properties, two properties of a missing loan shark at a slightly below market rate from the guy's grieving daughter while the department was still investigating, before the guy had been declared dead. So that was what I initially found in November, and I was ready to move on with my life. And then for a variety of reasons, sort of by accident, actually, I stumbled on the fact that I probably missed in that story the most interesting thing, which was that he scooped up some mob-owned, mob-connected properties after the feds crippled the Bonanno crime family.
Now, the Bonanno crime family is all over the city. Are we talking mostly about Staten Island here?
We're talking about the Bronx. So he is
the Bronx.
He's a Bronx guy, longtime Throgs Neck resident, has a lot of deep ties to the Bronx. He is currently the top cop on Staten Island, but he's only had that position for a few years.
And is the Bonanno crime family still an active force in the city?
The mob has been greatly reduced in sort of size and I guess ability, one might say,
because they testify against each other.
Well, despite
the rules of the mafia.
There have been a lot of reasons put out there for why that is. Certainly I've also talked to individuals that say they are still a presence in a number of different places. The ports have been thrown out as sort of one of the last, I think, cookie jars or candy jar was the term I'd seen. So, I don't think I don't think anyone would dispute that they're not what they were. But everyone I've talked to, they're not gone either.
What about the construction and real estate industries? Are they still popular places for mobsters to put their money?
I spoke to Jerry Capisi, who writes the Gangland News website, is, you know, considered probably the foremost expert on the mob in a lot of ways. And he says, you know, even in 2017, if you start looking into construction, you don't have to dig too deep to see at least some trace of the mob.
Isn't one of the properties that Della Torre owns a place where the mob used to hold induction ceremonies?
Yes, that was actually one of the fun little tidbits I found in researching the story. So one of the properties he purchased is 239 Robinson Avenue, and that home or the property, the original home has since been torn down, but that that property was owned by the mother of Dominic Sicali, who was a convicted murderer and actually testified against the acting boss at the time. And in trial testimony, he sort of talks about how that house, the house on that property, rather, was specifically used for some of these induction ceremonies where they'd sit around with like a candle and a knife and pins and saints and sort of, basically take an oath, swear allegiance to the family.
So it's like joining the Knights of Columbus or the Masons.
I'm unfamiliar with the Masons ceremonies.
But I just meant those kinds of organizations where you have secret ceremonies.
Yes.
Didn't you speak to Dominic Sicali?
I actually did. He called me yesterday after the initial story ran. It was fascinating. He has a lot of gripes, sort of complaints about the bank, actually. The bank, which is at the center, at the heart of a lot of Chief Della Torre's real estate dealings, is Ponce de Leon Federal Bank. It's a small Bronx-based bank that I found was a big lender on mob-connected properties or projects, rather, in the early 2000s.
Does anyone know whether the bank actually has explicit ties to the mob or just is willing to lend money to mobsters that maybe other banks might feel uncomfortable lending money to?
I think it's an important point to say that there have been no official allegations. They haven't been sued. They haven't been prosecuted. There has been nothing suggesting that they are, in fact, a mob bank.
How did the loans that Ponce de Leon Bank gave to the Bonanno crime family end up being held by Della Torre?
So there was an 8-unit apartment building in the Bronx on 217th Street that was owned by Dominic Sicali, as well as the wife of Vincent Bassiano, Vinnie Gorgeous, who was the acting boss of.
I love the names they gave themselves.
I could have spent 8 minutes probably just saying names in this piece, but it was owned by this sort of firm that they had. And after these guys were arrested, the loan goes into default, and it's a mess. The bank was in court for years sort of trying to get it off its books. Sicali, who was behind bars at the time, was basically alleging that the bank was sort of fraudulently trying to take the properties that he'd sort of worked with them while he was on the street. And as soon as he got put away, they were trying to sort of basically take his properties. That's what he alleged both on the phone to me, but also in court filings. And in March 2011, this sort of mystery investor with the bizarre name of the Chen Wang Realty Corp swoops in and buys this defaulted loan from the bank. And so they become essentially the new creditor. And then there's about 6 months later in September 2011, there's a foreclosure auction where Chen Wang then takes the property back. And I sort of pieced together that Chen Wang was owned by Chief Edward Della Torre's wife. And then later she then transferred the property from Chen Wang to an LLC that he was involved in.
So they gave it a Chinese name just to cover up the connection?
I have no idea. I asked his attorney that very, very explicitly if they were trying to sort of cover their tracks or something. And he said he did not know the origin of the name.
I wondered when I heard this story first why you would get your wife involved. Wouldn't that send up all sorts of red flags?
Well, I mean,
I would want to get some distant cousin, perhaps, and who I had an arrangement with.
Well, I mean, of course, that's assuming they did anything wrong. And what the lawyer has said is that she is a very sophisticated real estate investor. She is a licensed real estate broker. She clearly does work in sort of real estate and invests in properties. And so, what his attorney you know, says is that, look, there was nothing wrong with this. She's always looking for distressed properties in the Bronx in particular. These came up. They were a very good investment opportunity. They were dealing at arm's length with the bank. They weren't dealing with the mobsters. And so they decided to sort of pull the trigger and go on it.
And who's the legal owner of these properties now?
Well, currently they're owned by LLCs in which the assistant chief Edward Della Torre is a partner,
and they are obviously money making properties.
They would appear to be. There's one is an 8-unit apartment building which has tenants. The other, they're the one on 237-239 Robinson, appear to have tenants in them. Two of them, some of the other property, one of the other properties hasn't been built, hasn't been developed, but
did Della Torre and his wife get a good deal on these former Bonanno properties?
It appears that they did.
Make us suspicious?
Well, you know, if that's it certainly would appear to be something that's worth looking at, and I would imagine to the extent that there's an investigation of these deals, there will be some look at what the bank, the terms that the bank gave, and the degree to which they were able to get a good deal from the bank.
The reason I ask is anyone who has tried to buy property in New York in the last few years knows that even some of the most depressed properties are incredibly expensive. We've seen major inflated prices all throughout the city.
I would certainly imagine that the terms and prices in these deals is something that investigators will look at. And I would say that, you know, when they bought the loan, for example, they bought the loan on the 8-unit apartment building, the terms of that are not public. So we don't know what they actually paid for this defaulted debt. The three lots that they own on Robinson, it was a defaulted $990,000 loan for this sort of development construction. They purchased these properties for, I believe it was $375,000 from the bank.
My guest is Robert Lewis of WNYC. He is a George Polk Award-winning reporter, and his series NYPD Inc. is creating a lot of waves. We will find out some more about what he has uncovered after we take a little break. Stay with us. And we are back with Robert Lewis. We're talking about the series that he has been broadcasting on our news shows here. It's called NYPD Inc. And how did you wind up on this beat?
So I was actually out on leave, paternity leave, when news broke last spring of a major corruption scandal, an investigation, not only into sort of politicians and business leaders, but also into some high-ranking officials within the NYPD. And when I got back, my editor had sort of asked me, what can we do? Let's get into this. And there had been a small scoop early on where someone had pulled the financial disclosure filings of the chief of department, Philip Banks, who was named as at least being looked at in this. He hasn't been charged with anything. And that showed that he had received a bundle of money from a businessman who was also at the center of this probe. And it just got me thinking, like, does anyone actually look at these disclosure forms outside of, you know, sort of a breaking news event? And so that kicked it off. I started trying to figure out, well, how do you even get them? And it's this willfully difficult process to sort of get them. And I spent the next several months basically accumulating 6 years worth of these forms and digging into them.
And then developing whistleblowers?
You know, I really did not have many whistleblowers for this story. I mean, this was very heavily based on public records. Mm. I mean, this really I certainly have sources, but I used the disclosure forms and then dug deeper using court filings, real estate records.
One of the concerns some people have had about the shrinking of print journalism especially is that now, with fewer reporters covering local stories, this kind of thing just goes unnoticed. And yet it's really important.
You know, I in some ways have been surprised at the amount of praise, I guess I would say, or the good response to the stories, in part because this is such a basic type of quote unquote investigative story that you would think you'd see from every newsroom. You know, it's financial disclosure forms. What's in the financial disclosure forms? Someone pulls them, and you look and see what they say. And I don't know why it really hasn't been done on any broader scale. I mean, it is the system we have here in the city does make it very difficult to get them. But you raise a very good point.
Well, the George Polk people appreciate what you do. A listener, Stephen from Highland Park, New Jersey, asks on our show page if you've received any threats because of your reporting.
I have not. I had one NYPD press officer threaten to throw me out of a turkey giveaway after the first story ran. He might have been joking, but that's the closest I've received.
Didn't the Department of Housing Preservation and Development file a complaint in Bronx Housing Court about one of Delatorre's properties?
Yes, one of the apartment buildings he bought that had been owned by the loan shark. They was actually in what the city calls the alternative enforcement program. It's basically means that the conditions are so bad the city has the right then to go in, fix them, and then charge the owner. And so they did file a complaint.
Can potential conflicts of interest arise if a police chief is acting as a landlord?
One would imagine they could. I mean, you know, certainly the argument I've heard from the PD is sort of, you know, why it's sort of ridiculous to think that an official couldn't own property. I mean, how onerous are we going to make these restrictions on outside investments, outside income? You know, we're just going to lose people. And you know, it's a compelling argument, and,
well,
and
the
it
mayor
certainly
is
makes
also a
lot
landlord.
Of sense. Certainly, and so you know, some of it depends on how individuals conduct themselves.
But the stories you're telling seem to me would be sending off all sorts of alarm bells in the Department of Internal Affairs, because some of these lines are rather hazy.
I would think so.
In fact, one of you mentioned Delatorre's tenants is Democratic State Assemblyman Michael Benedetto. Has he commented on the arrangement?
He said Delatorre is a good landlord, and it says they just have a business relationship. They keep sort of personal separate from business, and it was a good location, central to his district, and so he's been happy with the arrangement.
How did Delatorre acquire that property that he leases to Benedetto? Didn't he pay close to nothing for it?
Well, so he originally purchased this. There was an LLC, including Delatorre, as well as the owner of a local newspaper, currently the chief of staff to Benedetto, who they purchased it as members of this LLC. And then at a later date, this chief of staff basically signed over his share of the property to Delatorre for what appears to be $0. It is unclear.
$0 is really cheap.
yes. So it is unclear, you know, necessarily why and all the terms and whatnot, or if there were other terms. But the public record seems to suggest no money was paid.
And Delatorre is working out of the Benedetto property. So is there a quid pro quo here?
I'm not prepared to say that necessarily, but I found him working out of there rather by accident. I had been going by the property, you know, looking who the tenants were, and went in the office where the sort of real estate operations were, and had intended to sort of leave a business card and asked some, you know, nice person sitting at the front desk, oh, does the chief ever come in? And they said, oh, yeah, he's in back. And it was a Monday afternoon, and so I had a chance to meet him.
Do we know if the NYPD's Internal Affairs Bureau has investigated Delatorre's actions?
Well, so the story on his purchase of the mob properties came out yesterday. Our City Hall reporter, Bridget Bergen, asked the commissioner at an unrelated press conference, and he said that in response that he had a conversation with the Deputy Commissioner of Internal Affairs, and they have opened an investigation.
My guest is Robert Lewis, who is a George Polk Award-winning reporter. We're very proud of that here at WNYC. And we're talking about what he's learned in his series, NYPD, Inc. Another person that you write about is Vincent Jimmy Durso. Can you tell us a little about him?
Vincent Durso was went missing. He was a father, a devoted family man, small time loan shark. Never charged with anything. Although the documents filed in surrogates court sort of show he did a little bit of money lending on the side. Who he dropped off his wife's home health aid in April 2010 and was never heard from again. His car was found sort of parked on a side street in the Bronx, and it was a couple of years, just about 2 years after his disappearance, that the daughter, his daughter, sold two of his properties to the chief.
To Delatorre
and Delatorre's wife.
Did the people you spoke to about Durso have any suspicions or hunches about why he went missing?
Nothing. It was speculation. He's never been found. And he was ultimately declared dead. He was declared dead after the chief purchased the properties.
And do we know about the circumstances of that transaction, buying that property from Durso's daughter?
It had to go through surrogates court. She was.
Was he investigating the disappearance?
It does not appear he was. No. I mean, I think that's an important point. There is no implication that he had anything to do with the investigation. There's no implication that he did anything to hinder the investigation. I mean, I have not heard any allegation like that at all. I do think that's an important point to make. What his attorney basically sort of says was that, hey, this was, again, an investment opportunity that just happened to come up, and you know, he didn't even really know who Durso was.
So how much did Delatorre pay for that property?
He paid $800,000. It was for two properties. He paid $800,000.
Is that below market value?
It was. As part of the surrogate court filing, there had been sort of a market appraisal, and it had put the value at, I believe it was $960,000. And the daughter basically had to get sort of court approval to sell it below. And, you know, she was dealing with a lot. She was still grieving the loss of her father, it would seem, and so she just kind of wanted to be done with it.
Did Delatorre buy the property himself or through one of his or his wife's LLC companies?
They bought it again through a corporate entity. Interestingly enough, again, if you look at the actual publicly filed deed, his name is not on it. But he signed the sale contract, which was not publicly filed, at least in the property records, that was included in the surrogate court filings.
If Durso's disappearance was still being investigated, does that mean that his family was financially vulnerable at the time of the sale?
I'm sure someone could make that case, that argument. I don't know.
On the other hand, is this an example of people assuming where there's smoke, there's fire, but there might actually not be any fire?
Well, and that is that's what his attorney would say. I mean, that's what Delatorre's attorney and probably some within the NYPD, at least the ones who were sort of trying to quash this story before it ran, that, you know, basically they're investors, and if you dig deep enough, you're going to find connections, and you can make anything seem dirty. But that the chief, you know, doesn't have anything to do with organized crime. His wife is a savvy real estate investor.
Is it possible that Delatorre bought the properties without even knowing about Durso's disappearance?
Certainly possible. They would have had to go through surrogate court, and there would have been a number of stages along the way where conceivably they would have an opportunity to sort of find out why things were getting delayed. This was a Throgsnek guy who went missing. Throgsnek is a small community. He lives in Throgsnek. It seems to me a little bit implausible that he wouldn't know. This was a big story there when the guy went missing. But that being said, it's certainly possible.
Doesn't Delatorre also own a private security company?
He does.
Successful is that?
It's all Borough Security. I was not very successful in figuring out where exactly they do work. I believe the last time I checked the state filings, they had 19 unarmed security guards on their roster. From some of the stuff I could find online, it looks like they maybe do some work in property buildings, guarding property buildings. But I don't know all of the locations where they are.
But this is not unique to Della Torre. A lot of cops also work as security guards when they're off duty.
Certainly. I mean, I don't know the extent to which active duty officers own security companies or are heavy investors in security companies. Certainly you probably look at the rank and file, you're going to find guys that are maybe working off duty at sort of Yankee Stadium or something. But this seems to be a little bit different.
We recently had the former head of the Internal Affairs Department as a guest on our show, and he said reasonably that most cops are honest, but you can almost guarantee that, like in any other group, there's going to be a few who are going to see this as an opportunity to make some money. Some of them enter the force with that in mind. Some of them, it occurs to them while they're on the force. So it seems to me you're going to have a lot of material for NYPD Inc.
I think you raise an important point there. And I had a conversation with the Deputy Commissioner for Public Information at one point. You know, and he made the point. He said at a certain point, the honor system has to kick in, right? I mean, these are big boys. These are law enforcement professionals. What kind of system do you have to create to catch everything? And how onerous is it? And is it realistic? And, you know, can you legitimately run every client that some cop moonlighting as a real estate agent has through some sort of database to see whether they have any connection? And is that even legal, using police resources, say, to sort of look into the background of someone just because they're doing dealings with an officer? So, I mean, it gets a little slippery as you go down the slope. And also, a big point the NYPD made over and over is that outside employment investments, this isn't unique to the NYPD. This is citywide.
But you said they can't work in bars or as locksmiths. Wouldn't a cop be an ideal bouncer in a bar or a nightclub?
Well, I think that's where the conflicts of interest potentially come in. Yes, you'd think they'd be an ideal person, but being in that situation, who is their loyalty to? Are they fulfilling their duties as a law enforcement officer? It has to do with again, it could be a conflict of interest. You're showing up because someone's house was broken into, and then you're sort of selling them locksmith services. So there's a whole list of jobs they're not allowed to have.
Robert Lewis has been reporting on NYPD Inc. He's received a George Polk Award, and my great thanks to him for being on our show today.
Oh, thank you so much for having me.